Welcome to Middle Grade Mavens, where two author mums discuss their favourite middle grade books, provide recommendations, and share insider industry tips for authors trying their hand at middle grade. Julie Ann Grasso is the author of the Frankie DuPont mystery series, cupcake enthusiast and part-time library book wrangler. Pamela Ukerman is a writer, dancer, and homeschooling mum who sometimes finds time for sleep. Both Julie and Pamela devour middle grade books, not only for research, but to share with their combined brood of four munchkins. Hi, Pamela, and welcome back to Middle Grade Mavens for our 59th episode.
Hello, Julie, and hello, everyone.
Yeah.
What have you been up to, Julie?
Well, it's been a heartbreaking week on the world stage. Yes, coronavirus continues to carve its mark into the lives of each and every one of us, but we cannot ignore what else is killing people, particularly of colour, throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just been unbelievable. But anyway, with our own country's shameful treatment of First Nations people and land, we acknowledge National Reconciliation Week, which occurred last week. And Pamela and I are really keen to play our part, but we just sort of thought, what can two mums with a tiny niche podcast do? And our best answer is that we can educate our children in doing better. We can also support authors of colour and buy books that showcase diversity. We can do our small part to help increase awareness, as well as donating to wonderful organisations like Indigenous Literacy Foundation. And the hope is that you, our listeners, will do this also.
Yeah, absolutely. As a mum, especially a homeschooling mum, I think it's really important to teach and discuss history and geography with your children. So much important conversation comes about from looking at the past and looking at geography, because geography, you know, it's quite political. And of course, we should make sure it's not a whitewashed history, which is not necessarily an easy thing to do. And one way I've addressed this for our homeschool study of Australian history and culture is by using books by Magabala Books, which is an Indigenous publishing house. It's Aboriginal owned and led, and they produce stunning picture books for younger and older readers, and other great books as well, including Bruce Pascoe's Dark Emu and Young Dark Emu, which are absolutely essential reading for every Australian. Now, if you check out the various children's bookshops' social media accounts, you'll find some great book list recommendations.
Yep.
And there are also Indigenous education organisations popping up with learning resources for both school and homeschool peoples. One of those that I've recently discovered is called Crackerjack Education. We're going to be looking at that next year when we go back to doing Australian history for homeschool. And so, yeah, we continue to have conversations, you know, with my kids. And my hope is that we are raising a next generation who will no longer find inequality by race or by gender acceptable.
Yeah, that is the desperate hope.
Yeah.
Yeah, sad times.
Yes, well, you know, it's a big learning year, let's just say.
Yes, yep. So what else has been happening?
Well, not a lot for me. We've actually been to the playground a couple of times.
Oh.
and we've seen some friends, which has been amazing, and it's really helped lift our spirits. But otherwise, I've been trying to find quiet time to write my book in between homeschooling.
Yes.
I'm working on a novel at the moment. Well, I'm always working on a novel, but I'm working on a novel that started a few months ago.
Yeah.
And with the colder weather, my boys are spending less time outside, so it's really, really hard to get uninterrupted quiet time to think and write, which is so important when writing a book, especially a novel.
Yes.
I can cook and clean and garden for ages in peace, but as soon as I sit down, they are onto me. I cannot understate the importance of flow when it comes to writing a book, just being able to continue your thoughts and, you know, finish them off without interrupt. And the thing is, I sent them all out to the supermarket today, all three of them, which was great. I thought, great, I've got an hour and a half. And then they called me.
Oh.
Just make a decision.
Oh, dear.
Anyway, dear. What about you? Have you been watching more Masterclass? I've done a bit of that too. So.
Yeah. Well, of course. Pamela and I think we've already said, if you listen to our previous episode, we've enrolled in Masterclass. And lately I've been discussing at length with Pamela the concept of beginnings. Mm. Let me explain why. So quite often I will pick up a blockbuster, start the first few chapters, and hurl the book across the room. Pamela thinks it's hilarious. Why, you ask? Well, I find books that take a long time to get into the action frustrate me no end, and I often discontinue reading. I like a book that starts in the action with little setup. Pamela, on the other hand, is happy to wait a bit longer, as long as the writing and the promise of a good story draws her in.
That's right.
So Pamela suggested I would love the R.L. Stine Masterclass. And for anyone who doesn't know him, he's the author of all those Goosebumps books. Anyway, I totally get his style. Start in the action, keep them turning pages, keep them asking what happens next. I love his style, and perhaps it is the actual reason that I often hurl blockbusters across the room. What are your thoughts, Pamela?
I'm glad you liked him. Yeah, I loved how Neil Gaiman and R.L. Stine had almost opposite styles in some areas, in some of their approaches to writing. Stine is obviously writing to a formula for a particular market, and a difficult one to reach at that. You know, he's looking at sort of 10-year-olds, reluctant yep. readers, whereas Gaiman is markedly unformulaic, meandering across different genres and audiences and even formats, because he does graphic novels as well. And Stine absolutely must end every chapter on a cliffhanger, which I know you love, but something that for me as a reader, I find a bit annoying, because I'd rather a good story told well than a lot of devices to keep me hanging on. But, you know, that suits his target audience. So, you know, it's just interesting to see that. And Neil has a stronger focus on voice and setting, which suits me more than plot twists and turns. Yeah, it is an interesting exercise to compare and see which techniques and which nuggets of advice suit your style as a writer. And actually, we just talked about this earlier before we came on, but the boys and I watched the Goosebumps movie yesterday. I'd never seen it before, but I've read a couple of Goosebumps books a long, long time ago. And my boys have been overhearing some of the R.L. Stine Masterclass as I was watching it. So they could recognize some of that in the movie, and if you haven't watched it, Jack Black plays R.L. Stine in yep. the movie, and it's about not just one of the books but all of the books, and so they were kind of laughing at some of the things that Jack Black as the character, as you know, as Stine, had to say about writing. And then towards the end, the real Stine has a little cameo. He kind of dashes across the screen.
Oh, fantastic.
And they were screaming with laughter. But yeah, they haven't really been into Goosebumps books before, but I think they're going to go and start reading them now after that. But anyway.
Well, I mean, I have to confess, I've never read a Goosebumps either. I've had them in my little free library out the front, and I just sort of put them in there because I knew that, you know, 10-year-old boys would walk past and take them, and they've always exited my library very quickly. But I haven't actually read one, but I'm going to have to now, because I'm totally in love with just his approach. I just think he's adorable.
Yeah, he's got a really sort of dry wit to the way he does horror, and he likes to borrow a lot of – he just borrows. He looks at 1950s horror movies and just borrows, you know, that idea.
Love
and
it.
It's so funny. Yeah, and the way he does it. And like my older son, Manga Boy, sorry, the 9-year-old, he was saying, it's not really horror, it's just tension. But it's funny enough that it's not too scary, which is – he's totally right. You know, I love that. Whereas Neil Gaiman, I haven't read a lot of his books, to be honest, because they're not really my style. But he sort of does that. He sort of does the same thing, and it just writes it in a different way, I think.
And he's just outright scary.
But yeah, just really interesting to look at. And kind of applicable to the next book I'm going to talk to the book I'm going to talk about, which we actually probably should get started on.
We should get to the reviews. Tell us, Pamela, what is the title of today's book?
Yep. So today I'm reviewing The Book of Chance by Sue Whiting, which was published by Walker Books on April 1st, 2020.
Oh, would you read the jacket blurb for us?
Yeah. For Chance Callahan, life is black and white, fake or real, right or wrong, truth or lies. There are no in-betweens. When a reality TV show starts filming, Chance's family is thrown into the spotlight and Chance uncovers a devastating truth. A truth that challenges everything that Chance believes is true. A truth from which there is no turning back.
Ooh, what genre would you class this as?
So it's middle grade contemporary, but I'd also say, and actually after speaking to Sue, a mystery slash crime novel.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Sue's previous book, Missing, was also a middle grade mystery slash crime. So, yeah.
I think Sue may have invented her own genre here for middle grade. Because it's not that common. So.
No. And yeah, in the interview, we do talk about it. And it's kind of her niche, I think. Yeah.
I love it. Yep. So what is the estimated word count?
Do you know, I didn't actually check that out, but I think it's about 40 to maybe 45.
Yeah. <Just guessing. laughs> It's always a guesstimate.
That's right.
And what drew you to this book?
So I did an online course that was run by Sue through the Australian Writers' Centre. 4 or 5 years ago. I think we said it was 4 years ago. So I've seen Sue's name around the traps. And last year I read her book Missing and enjoyed it. So I wanted this one too. And there aren't a lot of contemporary middle grade novels that are set in Australia. I think I just did The Tell a couple of weeks ago, which is one, and that's also sort of a thriller crime one. And in fact, as we heard in our Ask the Editor series, publishers are actually seeking middle grade contemporary set in Australia. So I was interested to read this one, and it's nice to read one written by such an experienced, skilled writer like Sue. So
yeah. So tell us about it.
Yeah. So Chance Callahan has just begun high school. She lives alone with her mother and she never knew her father. He died before she was born. But they aren't completely alone because they are practically family with their next door neighbours who are former refugees from Sudan. Chance's mother works tirelessly as a writer and helps new refugees settle into the country, so there isn't a lot of time or money for keeping up the house. So Chance nominates her house for a makeover on a popular reality TV show. When the show's crew come over to prepare for filming, Chance discovers a secret about her mum's past, which she can't ignore. And the more she digs, the more she realises that her whole life has been a lie. Now, I can't really say any more than that because it's a mystery.
Cannot give it away.
Cannot give away the mystery. So there you go.
So what was your overall enjoyment?
I was hooked into this story right away. Talk about, you know, tension and good storytelling. The details unfolded gradually and tantalizingly, and I really felt for this character, Chance. And within the story, Sue has addressed some pretty big issues, including responsible social media use, in particular cyberbullying, and the problem of how we portray ourselves online versus real life, and, of course, refugees. But what the book left me with, and I've talked about this before, how a good book should leave a question. And this book did exactly that. It left me with a question, something to ponder, which is, you know, what would you do in this situation? And I won't say what the question is, and I do talk about it with a bit more with Sue, but yeah, it really did leave me thinking, and yeah, I just couldn't stop thinking about it for a few days, and I really enjoyed it, pulled me right through.
Oh, and who will love this book? What age would you recommend it for?
It's recommended for 11 plus, and yeah, I'd agree with that.
And do you think this would suit reluctant readers as well, or is it for more confident?
I'd say it's more for confident readers, yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
Wonder if Sue's going to write a third middle grade crime mystery to make the trilogy.
I get the feeling that she quite likes this genre, so
yeah.
Keep an eye out. Watch this space, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Julie, what's the title of your book today?
Yeah, today is The Theory of Hummingbirds by Michelle Catarizman, published by University of Queensland Press on the 2nd of June 2020.
Great. Can you share the jacket blurb with us?
I will. Alba has been best friends with Levi since forever. They're both obsessed with hummingbirds and spend their lunch times hiding out in the school library. Alba normally doesn't mind that Levi's got a science theory on just about everything, but when he becomes convinced the school librarian has discovered a wormhole in her office, Alba thinks maybe he's gone too far. Then there's Cleo. That's what Alba calls her left foot, which was twisted in the wrong direction at birth and has been strapped in a brace for most of Alba's life. With the final cast about to come off, Alba is set on running in her first cross-country race. But what if Levi doesn't believe she can do it? Alba's only ever wanted to be normal, so why does it feel like she's losing more than Cleo and a pair of crutches?
Oh, interesting. I haven't actually heard of this book before. It sounds really good.
Yes, It was good.
What genre would you class it as?
This is an Own Voices middle grade contemporary.
Right. Okay. What was there? A wormhole in her office. Okay.
Yeah, well, I can't give it away, but yeah.
Okay. What's the word count for this one?
I'd say this is around 35K.
Okay, good length. And what drew you to this book?
Yeah, so I was offered it by UQP. And when I read the blurb, something really resonated with me. I guess I should explain. As a kid, I broke my femur, which is the sort of the biggest, your big thigh bone. And I spent lots of time in hospital, in casts, on crutches, having follow-up surgery to keep my legs from being different lengths. I became a pediatric nurse probably because of my experience as a child. And I also worked in the same hospital that I was a patient. So I think I can understand a story like this. It was sort of close to home, although I would never begin to understand the experience of having a club foot from birth, as my injuries were not from birth. I certainly felt that my 8-year-old self was going, oh, yes, I remember this. So,
right. Okay.
Yeah, that was a long-winded version of.
How did you break your leg?
Oh, back in the old days when trampolines didn't have any, nets, I fell through the spokes, that's not what they called, springs. And it just snapped. So, and
the old trampoline injuries, yes.
Yeah. And like we have a trampoline, but I held off for so long because so many kids break their legs on trampolines, even with the new version. So, anyway, let me not. Get on about that.
We've got one too. It's our most used thing in the whole for kids ever. But, I still. Ugh. Anyway, can you tell us more about the book?
Yeah. Alba has a club foot, which she calls Cleo, and a best friend named Levi. Levi has asthma, and for some reason, he and Alba have just always been best friends. Perhaps because Levi never bothered treating Alba any different. She was just Alba and Cleo came along for the ride. So when Levi thinks the librarian is a time-traveling librarian, Alba sort of runs with it. They begin their investigation of said librarian, but things go astray when it's all that Levi can focus on. He doesn't seem to care one bit about Alba having her first cast off soon and her determination to run in the school cross-country. Alba soon realises that friendships and goals don't always align.
Oh, sounds interesting. What was your enjoyment of this one?
I think I actually could say I devoured this book, which is high praise for me as I rarely devour books.
Yes.
I'm a really slow but persistent reader and it takes me time to mull over words, which is why I tend to the lower end of middle grade for word counts, I suspect. But right from the get-go, I was invested in Alba's story, and I was utterly intrigued by the potential wormhole-traveling librarian. I mean, who wouldn't be? And the journey of Levi and Alba's misaligned goals travels along so beautifully, and I couldn't help but be swept up in it. Now, the hummingbird theme that runs through this is both beautiful and poignant. And by the end of the story, I had to know everything about hummingbirds, which Michelle has kindly included a glossary at the end. Oh. And you will love this, Pamela. A group of hummingbirds is actually called a charm or a glitter.
Oh,
isn't that adorable?
That's gorgeous, yeah.
And there is actually a tiny hummingbird called the bee hummingbird, which makes a nest of cobwebs and lays eggs the size of peas. Isn't that something we must include in a magical realism at some point?
My cogs are turning, Julie.
Once I read that, I had to Google a bee hummingbird, and honestly, go and Google it. They are just exquisite. Now, also the fact that this was an own voices story made it so authentic for me. I loved Michelle's storytelling, and I would liken it to reading The Secrets of Magnolia Moon by Edwina Wyatt, and also Mika and Max by Laura Bloom. Both those authors just enveloped me in their prose, and I didn't want to finish reading. And it was the same for Theory of Hummingbirds.
Oh, sounds like a great book. Who will love this book? What age do you think?
I think this would suit 8+. Yeah, it's sort of on the lower middle grade, and for very good reason. I think that's the time where children they're just so open to diversity. And I mean, I think kids are open to diversity from much younger, to be honest, but I think they start to notice more at 8. And so, yeah, I'll definitely give this to Giselle, and I think she'll devour it.
Yeah, great. I think it's something that we as authors need to think about as well, is just sort of, you know, including diversity in all different ways in our books, you know, thinking about our own uniqueness and trying to include that in some way. You know, if we've got, you know, it doesn't have to be color, it doesn't have to be gender, you know, it can be all sorts of different things.
Yeah.
You know, and kids will be accepting, more accepting of those things. Do you think it's a good one for reluctant readers or more for confident readers?
I think this would suit both, actually. And I think it should be on the Premier's reading list. Because I really think it's vital that own voices stories like this are shared. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll look out for it.
Yeah.
The Premier's reading list comes out. I think each state has different reading lists.
Yeah, they do. And I think you can actually go and vote for it. So I might toddle on over there and do that.
Yeah, okay.
So. Yeah, that is it for our reviews, but don't we have a bumper episode this week, Pamela, because we have not one, not two, but three interviews.
Indeed.
Yes. Sue Whiting stops in, as well as Michelle Catarusman, and we have the wonderful Kate O'Donnell from the Younger Son Bookshop back for some ripper book recommendations. So stay tuned, folks.
Yeah, awesome. And next week will be our last episode for this series, and we're going to take a little break. Just, you know, much needed break. But you'll have plenty of episodes to catch up on, so
yes.
Yeah, keep in mind. See you next time.
Stay tuned, folks.
Sue Whiting is a children's and YA author and editor who has worked in publishing for 2 decades. Sue was Senior Commissioning Editor and Publishing Manager for Walker Books Australia for many years before leaving in 2016 to concentrate on her writing. She is the author of numerous books, including the best-selling Missing, the award-winning A Swim in the Sea, and the CBCA notable books Platypus, Get a Grip Cooper Jones, and Beware the Deep Dark Forest. The Book of Chance is Sue's latest middle grade novel, and Sue's here with me to talk today. Welcome to the podcast, Sue. It's great to have you on.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here.
So let's dive in and talk about the Book of Chance. First of all, I noticed it's a sort of middle grade mystery suspense novel in a similar way to your book Missing, which was released last year. Was that intentional or did it just come from the story?
It's a little bit of both, but it was mainly intentional because after I'd finished Missing and found and had such a really fabulous response from readers, I was on the hunt for another idea that I could sort of mould into that sort of mystery suspense genre and for that particular age group. So it was quite intentional. I was on the hunt.
Okay, there's not a lot, not that I've read anyway, of mystery suspense novels for middle grade. So I think it's great.
It's something I really enjoy, actually. I've always enjoyed mystery and to read and to write, but this particular age group and this type of sort of mystery suspense, I'm really enjoying writing, actually. So I think I've sort of found my little niche in some ways as well.
Oh, that's really good to hear. I was really drawn into it from the very beginning. So, yeah, and held me all the way. So,
oh, good.
Now, you included at the back of the Book of Chance a note on what inspired you to write this book. I know yes. People love hearing where authors get their ideas from. Can you share that story with us without giving too much away of the story?
I can share some of it because I can't, I never reveal what the crime was. So it was inspired by a true crime.
Yeah.
But I never reveal what the crime was because that would give away a lot of the central mystery.
Yep, exactly.
And even though it's not the same crime, it's similar. Mm-hmm. So the crime that inspired my story was committed in 1998, but it wasn't solved until 2017. And I kind of remember when it happened way back in 1998, but when it was solved in 2017, it was a huge story. Big world news was on all the outlets, and I was kind of fascinated by the story as it was unfolding, and I was particularly fascinated and a little bit worried actually for the teenage girl who was at the centre of it and was embroiled in this crime and the consequences of the crime. And I started to really worry and wonder about that girl, and that's when the idea for the Book of Chance came, having that same kind of idea. What would it be like to be that girl, and how would you cope with your life being turned around or upside down and inside out in this way? So that's where it all came from.
Yep, it came from real life. Yeah. So, one of the main topics explored in this book is that not everything is black and white, right or wrong. And it's quite a relevant theme to explore for the target age group because kids that generally are black and white when they're younger. And I loved how you wrapped this in some quite important and pertinent social themes, cyberbullying or responsible digital citizenship and refugees. At what point did these topics find their way into Chance's story?
Well, that's a really interesting question, that one. With the refugee thread through the story, I actually can't remember a time when that wasn't part of the story. Okay. And so once I started to think about how I would, what Chance's story would be and how I was going to write it, what was going to happen, one of the first decisions I made was to make Nadia, Chance's mum, settle in Wollongong. And once I had her settled in Wollongong and starting a new life there with Chance as a baby, immediately the Deng family were next door, and they're a refugee family. They were new arrivals at that time when they first when Nadia first went to Wollongong. Yep. And they were always her next door neighbours. And I think the reason for that was at the time when I was sort of working all this out, there's a wonderful organisation in Wollongong called SCARF Refugee Support. And I was very interested in the work that they do in supporting new refugee families or families from refugee backgrounds in Wollongong. And I was hoping to do some volunteering for them. I haven't actually done very much because time hasn't allowed me to, but I have. I was interested in that organisation. I think that's why that element came through, because that was something that I was sort of interested in and following up at the time. Now, with the cyberbullying and the social media element of the story, that sort of came about because when I started to think about this true crime and how I'd make it into a story, and it's basically a story about a girl who discovers her whole life has been a lie, she's not who she thinks she is. And so I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if I could sort of explore this idea about truth in different ways? And one of the things, or truth and lies, I suppose, and one of the things that's always fascinated me and I've been sort of intrigued by is how we ever know what is true. It's so hard. We don't ever know. We don't know what people are thinking. We don't know what are in people's minds. We don't know if someone's speaking the truth. We can make some judgment calls, but we don't ever really know. And I think in this day and age, it's even trickier for kids and adults, but kids in particular, to know what is true. You know, they turn on the media and there's people, you know, saying this is fake news, this isn't true. They go onto social media and people are, kids and adults are creating these fictions online. They, you know, they're posting things that are not necessarily a true depiction of who they are, and they've got putting on filters and they're doing, you know, fancy things and making their lives look quite perfect, and often they're not. And I just thought that that was that really dovetailed in really nicely with this whole idea about a girl who discovers that her whole life has been a lie.
Yeah, it's probably even more pertinent now with the pandemic and everything that's going on in the world.
Absolutely.
Conspiracy theories and it's really hard.
And how do you know what is true? You know, I've got some theories, but it is hard to know who to believe and what's true. And I think it's made all the more difficult with social media, where just everyday lives you don't even know aren't true necessarily.
Yeah, and it's such a minefield for kids when they first get into
so hard. Yeah, so hard.
I felt like this book ended on a very interesting question, you know, what would you do, basically? I've spoken before about how I like books that leave a question or something to think about for the reader. Was this your intention from the beginning, to sort of leave this people wondering, you know, what would they do in that situation?
I think any story that has a sort of a moral dilemma, which Chance has at the end of this story, and obviously it was all going to be heading towards that, it's never neat. There's not a, it can't be a neat ending. It's going to have huge choices that are going to have consequences, and life's messy. It's not neat, and so there's always more than one way to do things and to view things, and they all have their own consequences. So that's something that's always interested me, and I also always like to try to tell my stories in a way that they are thought-provoking, so that even with the social media thread, there's a lot of issues that are brought up through that thread, but I'm not giving any answers. I'm just showing that it's tricky and messy and complicated. And so it's really to get my readers to think and to hopefully talk and nut out some of these things and question some of the things that they might do or see or hear. And definitely at the end, I think readers will think that Chance has done the right thing, and some will think that Chance hasn't, that they would have done it differently. And I think that that's good, because that's what life is like.
Yeah, exactly. Or even just, you know, like thinking about, I mean, for me, I was thinking, what would I do in that situation? And there's no easy answer, right?
There is no easy answer.
It's not black and white.
Not black and white. No, absolutely. Life's not black and white, you know. No. So, and that's what something that Chance had to learn about, really, because she saw life as being very black and white up until that point, you know.
Yeah. It all tied in really well there. So missing your book last year was based in Panama, which I'm sure would have required a lot of research.
Yes.
And the Book of Chance is set, as you said, in Wollongong, which I think you're quite familiar with. But was there much research for this book?
Yes, not as much as Panama. So when I was writing Missing, I've never been to Panama, and I didn't have the funds to go there for a research trip. So I did question my sanity at times. Why did I choose this place to set my book in? And I actually researched, I think, that for about 12 months. And I had a couple of lucky breaks and got to meet some people who lived in the town, you know, via the internet, and were able to help me out in great, great, you know, ways. So when I came to start thinking about the Book of Chants and where I was going to set it, I decided quite deliberately to set it in Wollongong for two reasons. One is because Wollongong very rarely features in books, and I thought that would be good to address. And secondly, yes, it's familiar to me. So I live about a half an hour from Wollongong, and it's my city. So it's my closest city, and I belong, you know, live in the Wollongong area. Mm-hmm. So I thought this will be, I'll go easy on myself, you know, this will be easy because I know, you know, Wollongong. But it was actually quite difficult. So while I didn't have to do as much research as I did for Panama, I still found it really challenging because it was so familiar, I think. Okay. So I had to really dig deep to work out and take notice of things to see what would be interesting to readers and how I could bring it to life for readers when everything just seemed very familiar and normal I had to spend a lot of time walking the streets of Wollongong. I walked all the streets that Chance walks down and had to take sound grabs and photos. And I'm sure some people thought I was a bit of a stalker at times. The house that Chance and the Dengs live in are actual houses in Wollongong. Mm. I've hidden their location a little bit, but if you're clever, you could work it out. And I spent a lot of time walking up and down past those houses, taking photos, and I'm sure people thought I was casing the joint.
Well, it came alive. I mean, the local sort of shops and everything, it felt
good.
Australian, but, you know, for me, I'm in Melbourne, so I don't know Wollongong, but it still felt, you know, Australian, but like it could be anywhere in the suburbs near here. So,
yeah.
And so there would have been much research around the sort of criminal aspect of it, the crime, or around the refugees?
Yes, absolutely. There was definitely research around those areas. So the crime, I watch lots of detective shows and true crimes and lots of shows. So TV and movies were really helpful. I also was fortunate to be able to interview a detective from the forensic part of Wollongong Police Station. And I still have the serviette where she drew crime scenes for me. And so that was very helpful to make sure that that I got the facts right and that it made sense. And she gave me some really good, just little things that you wouldn't necessarily know that just helped to sort of bring it to life. Yep. Some things that I wouldn't have used in it, but it made some of my assumptions work, if you know what I mean.
Right, yep.
And the refugee part, yes, I did have to obviously do a lot of research into South Sudanese people in particular and their refugee stories. And again, I was very fortunate to find someone in Wollongong, or she originally from Wollongong, who had a very close relationship, very similar, it was very spooky actually, very similar relationship to Nadia and the Callahans and the Dengs. It was this is very spooky because this is what I've been writing about. They were like family.
Yeah.
And so she was wonderful, and she'd known them for, you know, 10, 15 years, this particular family. She was my sensitivity reader as well. So she and that particular family really helped to make sure that I didn't make any big, you know, mistakes with that particular element of the story.
Because you included quite a bit of the culture in there as well, which was really nice.
Yes, and I think it's a very rich culture and there's some wonderful people within that culture, and it was nice to sort of celebrate them a little bit.
Yeah. So how quickly did you go from idea to the book being released? And were you already contracted to write this, or did you have to then pitch it and sell it to the publisher?
This is actually one of the very few stories that I was actually contracted to write. So usually I would write a manuscript and then send it off to my agent or to the publisher and cross my fingers and, you know, sit and wait. But this one came about when not long after, I suppose I must have finished Missing, and it was maybe I just finished the editing process of Missing and I was getting ready, you know, to be put into pages and the final stages of production. And I had a meeting with my publisher and you know, she said, "What are you going to be writing next, Sue?" And I sort of said, "Well, I've got this idea," and I had been thinking about this idea of the Book of Chance. It wasn't called the Book of Chance then. It was just, really was just an idea. Mm-hmm. And she said, "Oh, that sounds really good. Would you like a contract?" And I went, "Oh, okay." So, which was, you know, obviously I had to do a little bit of work before she gave me the contract, and that I, you know, gave some samples and a synopsis and, you know, thought it through a little bit more. Yep. But so I was contracted to write it before I'd actually written the story, and which was fabulous, but also had some added pressure, of course, because you had to deliver then, you know, you couldn't have that luxury of thinking, oh, this isn't working, I'll try something different. I had to sort of see it through, yep. which was a good discipline for me, and it worked out in the end.
Okay. Yeah. I guess after having, you know, you've done quite a few books now and you've won a few awards, and Missing did really well. So you're at that point now where, you know, they can trust you a little bit more.
Yes. I felt that. And that's like a double-edged sword too, because yeah. there is that level of expectation, which sometimes yeah. can go, which makes it difficult. But you know, it was good. And it was a nice feeling to be able to sit there and know that this was going to be a book, not just something that might end up in my bottom drawer.
Well, I'm sure, you know, as myself and Julie, you know, we all know what that's like. So it's nice.
Yes. It's nice. Happens to us all.
Yeah. So you're obviously an experienced editor and ex-publishing manager. So I'm interested to hear, how much editing did your manuscript need by somebody who was not you? How much does an experienced editor need to be edited?
Lots. I actually really love being edited. Yes, when I say that, I also get sometimes, you know, get the editorial report and you just sort of want to crawl under a doona and disappear for a day or two. Yep. But I really value, sure, there's things that I know about writing, but we all do. And it's very hard to be objective of your own work. Yep. And you just need someone else to look at your work in that objective way. And so I very much value editors looking at my work, and the editor for the Book of Chance was Nikki Foreman. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I love about Nikki and any good editor is the love and care and attention that someone else is giving your book. You know, mm-hmm. you think this person has really looked at this book and thought about it so carefully and come up with all these different, you know, raised a whole lot of different issues and was, you know, really challenged me to get the best out of the idea. Now, I don't always agree with everything that the editor says, but I always give it very lots of consideration. And sometimes I'll make changes, and if they don't sit well with me, I might, you know, change back or make a different kind of change. But it's always with consultation, and it makes you really think about your story and the things that are really important to you. So if there's something that's really important to you and then that part's challenged, I think it's very useful to really think, why is it important? And maybe it's not important. And then you do find the things sort of rise to the top. You go, actually, this is something that's really important to this story, so I'm going to fight for this particular one, or see if there's another way we can tackle it. Or others can go, actually, what was I thinking? You know, that doesn't need to be there. That's, you know, so it's very good to, I really like being edited, and I love, you know, someone else's perspective and on your own book. It's quite revealing and exhilarating sometimes to see the things that they notice and things they like and the things that they think could use some improvement.
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice to have that sort of idea that there's a book in the end is a collaboration, and
sure is
brought out the best in you know what this book can be. Yeah. Now you were and are the presenter for the course. Well, you were the presenter for the course Writing for Children and Adults at the Australian Writers' Centre when I did it a few years back.
Yes.
And I know offline you said that you're still doing that.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I am. So yes, I actually started working for them even before I finished working at Walker Books. Wasn't meant to work that way, but it worked up that way because I stayed a little bit longer at Walker. So it's been about just over four and a half years now, I suppose. Yeah. About four years.
I think that's
and yes, yeah, you might have been one of the first. I don't know. Yeah. So yes, I've been doing quite a lot of work with them recently because I've been housebound, funnily enough. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, I do lots of different, when you're, as you'd appreciate, when you're working for yourself from home or from, you know, just for yourself, you have to have lots of different ways to earn income, particularly in the arts, as you just can't rely on one element. So it is a good thing. I really like to, I also do the face-to-face course over a weekend as well.
Oh yeah,
and I enjoy doing that as well. So yeah.
Yep. And I know you juggle editing and mentoring and school visits in all amongst yes. that as well with your writing, you know, to earn that extra bit of money. Well, not extra, but the money that you need, obviously.
Yes. So
how much time do you spend on actually writing? Do you get a lot of time for that?
Well, it varies. So I have to make time. So it's really, I see it as that I'm my own boss, so I have to make the decisions. And so I'm in charge of that really and working out my time. So it really depends on what's happening. Like at the moment, it's very different. So the year that I was embarking on at the beginning of this year is not the year that I'm actually living. So it's been actually great that I have lots of different ways, as I was saying, to earn an income, because this year, because I had two books coming out and I had been sort of scaling back the editing and mentoring and tutoring for the AWC, I've been scaling back that part of my income stream and my employment, so to make way for more time for writing and touring and school visits. And so this year I had a very big year planned. I had a book tour planned for the Book of Chance with Walker Books, and I had lots of conferences and festivals and school visits and interstate trips and all sorts of things. And then around about the 8th or 9th of March, I think they started, the tour was cancelled, and then everything else, every time you open your email, something else was cancelled. And so, and I'm not alone there. It happened to everyone. And so I've been very grateful that I did have my editing and the tutoring with AWC to fall back on. So the last few months I have scaled back up that part of my business and have been doing a lot of editing and mentoring and manuscript assessment, and which has been great. It's given my day shape when I've been in isolation and purpose. And plus it's helped me to earn some income, which is really grateful. I'm grateful for in this particular climate. Yeah. And, but I plan in the next couple of weeks, this is a very long answer to your question, when do I write? So in a couple of weeks, we've got another couple of weeks of work, and then I'm planning to spend the next couple of months until I'm back into schools again, writing. So it's really about planning. So I do try to plan out, and not overcommit. Not always successful, but I do try to carve out some time for writing.
Yeah. I just think, goodness, this whole thing happened. Like at just at the point where the internet is actually quite good and quite reliable, and not say 5 or 10 years ago. Because
I know. Yes, we actually got the NBN on just the day before lockdown.
we got not long before, a few weeks before. So yeah, and it's still been a bit of a struggle, but it would have been far worse.
It would have been, yeah. And like even things like Zoom and different platforms, been quite amazing. You know, we have been able to still connect, and I have still been doing some, you know, workshops and book clubs and, you know, Facebook Live readings and all those kind of things. So there have been ways to sort of connect with readers and do that part of my job too. But I have been mainly focusing on doing the editing and mentoring and manuscript assessment.
Yeah. And you have another book that's just come out with Walker Books, a picture book. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So that's called Good Question. And it's illustrated by Annie White, who also illustrated Beware the Deep Dark Forest. Mm. And it's, I suppose, a twisted sort of fractured fairy tale. And it's the story of a fox who's up in a tree, and he tells the tale of why he's up in the tree. And so it's really about him being a very hungry fox, and trying to get a meal, and he just sort of ventures into all the wrong stories that he doesn't belong in and doesn't get a meal, but just gets into trouble. And so it's a bit of fun. It's told from the fox's point of view, and he's, you know, he's an interesting character with I think a strong voice, and so lots of fairy tale references and lots of fun, and it's actually good to have something really lighthearted and fun, I think, for kids to immerse themselves in this time. So that was good.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we'll have to look out for that one.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, Sue, are you ready for our 6 quick questions?
Oh, yes. It's late on a Sunday afternoon.
Oh, well, I tell you what, a lot of these interviews I've been doing at 8, 9 o'clock at night. So I'm actually.
Oh, well, okay.
You're lucky. Okay, so keyboard or pen and paper?
Pen and paper to start with. Keyboard when I'm, got right into the book.
Yep. Favorite writing snack?
Varies. Sometimes chocolate, sometimes some hummus, sometimes potato chips, but always coffee.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one constant. It's not really a snack. Well, you know the answer to the next one.
That was my next point to your coffee. Anyway, I like the hummus too. Hummus is my thing. Okay, so ebook or the real thing?
Oh, the real thing, without a doubt.
Cats or dogs?
Dogs.
Mm-hmm. And comedy or tragedy?
I wonder if you can guess.
Oh. I don't know. I think you've got a comedy and a tragedy right now, haven't you?
I do. As I said that, I thought that's a bit mean. I actually really like tragedy.
Okay.
To be honest, I like a book that's really intense, and or a film that's intense, and I like ones that evoke strong emotions, like crying. I like to have to shed a tear or two in a book. So yeah, I think tragedy is more.
I think
for me.
You're the first author that's actually said only tragedy.
There you go. I do like to laugh too.
Yeah. No, that's good.
I don't read a lot of comedies because I was thinking about writing something humorous not so long ago. And then I thought, but I don't really read humor very much. You know, I don't avoid it, but I don't read it very much. I mean, I think I have a sense of humor and I like to laugh, but I don't think I'm one to write comedy.
It's not your thing.
I'll leave it to the experts.
You know, we always need a mix. We can't all have the same thing and be all the same.
That's right. So that's right. Yeah.
And where can our listeners find you if they want to find out more about your books?
Okay. Well, I have a website. So that's suewhiting.com. I'm also on Instagram and Twitter. And that's at suewhiting4. And I have... a Facebook author page, Sue Whiting Author. So lots of different ways.
Good. The Book of Chance and Good Question are both out now from all good bookshops.
And yes.
Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure. And I'm so glad we got to chat after sort of having met a little bit online.
Yes. I know. It's been fabulous. So thank you so very much. And thanks for doing these podcasts too. It's great to have middle grade books showcased in this way. So really appreciate it.
It's our pleasure. It's a lot of fun.
Here we are at Middle Grade Mavens, and a little recap for our listeners. We've recently reviewed The Theory of Hummingbirds, which was published by University of Queensland Press in June 2020. Now, I personally find it fascinating to hear the story of how a book came to be. We thought it would be awesome to invite Michelle into the Middle Grade Mavens hot seat for some authorly banter. And guess what? She agreed. So hi, Michelle.
Hi, Julie.
I've realised I actually didn't say The Theory of Hummingbirds by Michelle Catarusman.
That's okay.
Which is incredibly amateur of me, but anyway, you get the drift.
I do, and thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited. I've got to tell you that this is my first ever interview in Australia.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow. So we love taking the
event for me.
Taking the relay torch as the first one. So now tell us, Michelle, where did you get your start in writing?
So I got my start in writing in short stories for a kids magazine, a publication here in Canada called Chirp, and another called Chickadee. So I live in Toronto in Canada right now. I've been here since 2000.
Wow.
So my career as a writer really has only been while I've been living in Canada, which is why this is my first interview in Australia.
Oh, fantastic.
But I, from writing short stories for magazines, I built my confidence from there, and I wrote my first novel. It was a YA novel. It was a part of a series for reluctant readers called Side Streets. It was like high-low. I don't know if you use that term in Australia, high-low.
No, we don't.
Yeah, it's like high action and low vocab. So it's, you know, it's great for reluctant readers.
Oh, fantastic.
It was, and it was great to get that first novel out. But, you know, YA is not where my heart lies. Middle grade was really always my passion. So I didn't continue with YA. I sort of kept going with my middle grade projects. And, you know, many, many, many rejections later,
yes.
As all writers go through, you know, I received my first publishing contract for The Theory of Hummingbirds by my North American publisher in 2017. And I feel like that was my big break. And
yes.
I'll never forget getting that email from an editor saying that they'd plucked the manuscript from a slush pile and that they loved it. And I'll never forget it because I was driving and my son was reading up. So my son was reading out my messages to me and I thought he was joking. I thought he was my leg. And I was like, that's really mean. And it wasn't until I could actually read it myself that I believed it. And
gosh.
Yeah. So since it's been a great collaboration with my Canadian publisher, and I've just done a third for them.
Oh,
but
brilliant.
That was where it all started.
Oh, what an incredible beginning story. That's so encouraging.
Yeah, I think it's always a bit of a long road, isn't it? I mean, it's that thing, looking back, it was easy. But when you look back over the years, it's like it's a really, it's a struggle to keep going when you do, to keep writing what you really want to write.
Yeah.
I guess I always knew I could go back to sort of the high-low and the YA and the magazine stuff, but I really wanted to write middle grade. And so I was really lucky. And a lot of it's, you know, it's like the stars align and,
yeah.
You know, so the right person reads the right thing at the right time. And, you know, there's a lot of, I think, good fortune and luck involved too.
Yeah, of course. So where did you get the inspiration for The Theory of Hummingbirds?
Well, essentially I wanted to write a story about self-acceptance. You know, we all have something that makes us feel different. And it could be something obvious like Alba's clubfoot in the story, but often it's not. Often it's something that is hidden and no one else knows about. So knowing that we all feel different somehow, it really begs the question, so what is normal really? And is it that important?
Yeah.
You know, and using hummingbirds as the analogy to the theme, it felt perfect after I read a fact that appears actually in the first line of the book, which is hummingbirds can't walk.
Yes.
And which kind of at the time struck me, but of course they can't walk. They don't need to. They fly so beautifully.
Yeah.
So we all have that special thing, that unique thing about us. So ultimately the story is about loving yourself for who you are. And Alba has a clubfoot. It could have been anything to make her feel different, but she has a clubfoot because I had a clubfoot.
Yeah.
So that was I had a disability when I was a child. So that's how those two kind of themes went together.
Yeah, and I guess for my third question was that this is an own voices book, and you've mentioned, you know, that you have lived this experience. Can you give us, I guess there might be some listeners that don't really understand the term own voices yet. It's sort of maybe a new term to them. Could you give us a little insight in what that term means?
For sure. To me, the term means, it indicates a book written with direct experience from a group or a community or a culture, and most often from a marginalized or underrepresented voice.
Yes.
So in the case of Theory of Hummingbirds, it's an own voices book because I had the same disability as Alba has. And, you know, disability in kids' literature is something that really is hugely underrepresented.
Yes.
But I think own voices is most commonly here in North America anyway attributed to a cultural and diversity book. And I guess it's a phrase now that's very interchangeable, but certainly disability comes under that same banner.
Yeah, definitely. So let's get back to the actual book. How much editing did you have to endure before it was ready to go to print?
I actually really like the editing process, I have to tell you. I like the revisions and the editing. I don't know, maybe I'm a nerd.
I do too.
Yeah, I mean, it's the first draft for me that is just like splitting rock, you know, and it's just so difficult for me to get out that first draft. But after that's out and I can get to kind of mold and shape, I really like it. So that's where I feel like I'm more in control. And I think for this one, for this project, the editor and I were back and forward for about a year, I guess, less than a year. We had to do a lot of sort of fact checking and about this one, but because I was referencing medical terminology and experience from
my era. Long time ago.
Yeah, and we had to sort of make sure that it would be in line with current for a girl who had the current problem. So. I have to say I like the editing.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people don't, like, you know, to get your manuscript back with all those comments and red lines, and it can be kind of daunting, but I have a very gentle editor as well. So, that always makes the experience much nicer.
Yeah, of course. So releasing a book in the time of a pandemic is pretty daunting. What is your recipe for sending a book into the world during this uncertain time?
Recipe I say yes. I say yes to everything. But no, I mean, there's nothing that can replace, of course, going into a classroom and, you know, meeting educators and students and, you know, going to a book signing and being able to meet the readers. Of course, there's nothing that can replace that. But, you know, I'm so grateful to the online book community, like Mavens.
Thank you.
Who are giving authors, you know, an opportunity to talk about their books virtually. You know, it's really important. So I'm very grateful. And I'm actually promoting three books, Theory of Hummingbirds release in Australia and also its Spanish version in South America. Yeah, and I just released another middle grade book internationally called Music for Tigers. So I had to get over my sort of tech phobia and sort of just get over myself and jump in and do the Instagram Live and the Facebook Live and, you know, webinars and all that stuff. So now it all just feels like kind of second nature to jump on Zoom and talk to a classroom. But I guess there was a learning curve at the start. And now it's kind of like, great, I can, you know, I can speak to, you know, a classroom in Colombia from my living room. It's pretty awesome.
Brilliant.
I think, you know, hopefully when we get back to being able to do things more traditionally, you know, to be able to meet face to face, that will just kind of, that will be a whole new kind of way to launch the books and kind of go back and for a different audience. So,
yeah. So my next question was, do you do school visits? And I guess I kind of assumed that this wasn't your debut because of your YA. But it's, I mean, have you been able to do school Skype visits or Zoom visits in that time, or is that something you'll plan for the future?
Well, I've done a lot of school visits when Theory of Hummingbirds came out in the US and Canada in 2017. So I've done a lot of school visits since then with this book. I've released two more since then as well. So I love going into classrooms. It's really my favorite thing to do as a kids author. I think we all probably agree on that, you know, meeting students and is incredible. And I've been lucky enough to go to classrooms in around the world. So it's, you know, I really look forward to being able to do that again.
And have you got any sort of moments that you would consider really special where you've connected with a reader?
Yes. I'll tell you a fun one and then I'll tell you a much more moving one. So there's a character in the story, Abigail Pontifax, who in The Theory of Hummingbirds, and she has a very small part in the book. Like, she's only in one scene in the book, but people tend to remember her. And she has pig braids. because she couldn't decide how to wear her hair. So she's got one side in a ponytail and one side in a braid, in a plait, yep. We call it in Australia. And I turned up at this school, and they'd invited me because the book was on a school board reading competition. So they had all read the book, which is always great.
Yep. But
so when I got there, the first row of girls all had their hair done in the pig braids.
Oh my gosh.
It was so cute. So that was lovely. But yep. Really the most meaningful moment, the most meaningful moment of my career as a writer, I have to say, came from a disabled reader who'd been given the book, The Theory of Hummingbirds, and she has a physical disability. She's restricted to a wheelchair.
Yeah.
And at the time, she was having to go through so many medical appointments, and she told me that the parable within the book, The Hummingbird yes. and the Fire, was really helping her. That story was really helping her get through these appointments. She showed me her journal that she had written out the parable herself and done her own illustration, and she carried this journal with her to the hospital appointment. So,
aww.
You know, to know that helped this brave young woman, I mean, it tops anything that, anything that I could, in any accolades you could get as a writer. I mean, that's really when you feel that, well, this is all just.
You've done your job.
Right, yep. Right. It means so much.
Oh, that is magic. Yep. So, Michelle, do you personally read widely in the genre and age that you write for?
I love middle grade. I love middle grade books, and I do read widely, and especially now I've had time to actually catch up on some middle grade books I haven't, didn't have a chance to read.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why, the question of why I like to read middle grade is probably the same as why I like to write it. I mean, I guess I like hanging out with my 11-year-old self. I mean, it's such a fun time. I think it's, you know, thinking back to childhood, that was when I had a lot of fun. So I really do enjoy spending time in that genre.
Yeah.
In both writing and reading.
So can you think back, or even to now, one middle grade book that you would love every child to read?
I'm going to be a bit of a party pooper. I'm going to say, I don't think there's a one size fits all when it comes to reading. I think that for sure there's a book out there for every reader that's going to hook them and turn them into a lifelong reader. Yeah. I really do believe there is that one book that just, you know, hooks you. But I think it's vastly different for each child. And which is why podcasts like this, you know, is so important for parents and educators, you know, to learn about what's out there. And, you know, booksellers and teachers and librarians, they're the real superheroes when it comes to putting the right book in the hands of the right reader.
Yeah.
You know, it's a real art. And I think that's where, you know, the focus is really, is because it's such a specialized thing to do. And it has such impact, you know, when you can have that right book. But yeah. I don't have a go-to book that's going to, I think, is going to, you know, everyone should read.
Yep. I'd have to say I'm probably the same after reading so many middle grade books for like 12 years. So, yeah. Right.
Yeah. And, you know, I think back to what impacted me as a reader when I was young as well. And there's not like one Shazam, like one book that kind of did it either. You know, I loved Enid Blyton and Little Women, but it was just, you know, losing myself in the pages was, you know, just that act of doing that, I think.
Yeah, made me sure.
Be a reader.
So you have mentioned your other book that's just been released, and I'd love you to talk about that. But do you have any other projects on the go that you can mention?
My work in progress is actually my father's Indonesian, my mother white Australian. I grew up in Melbourne, and I left in 93, such a long time ago, and then I lived for almost a decade in Indonesia.
Yeah.
So a previous novel, Girl of the Southern Sea, was set in Jakarta, and my work in progress is going back to Indonesia.
Oh, it's brilliant.
It's going to be about... orangutans and palm oil industry and, you know, the exotic black market, pet trade, activism. But middle grade again. So that's what I'm working on. I actually have a research grant, and I had to cancel, of course, my plans to visit Borneo.
Sad.
So as soon as the world, it'll still be there. So once it's safe to travel again, I'll be over there doing that research.
Oh, brilliant. So tell us about, was it Music for Tigers?
Music for Tigers. So this is the first book that I've set in Australia, and it's just released in internationally. So it's released in North America. And it's about a Canadian girl she's a violinist, and she's sent to her mother's bush camp in the Tarkine in Tasmania. And there she discovers that her family have a secret sanctuary for endangered and extinct marsupials, but the camp is threatened by mining and logging. So it's another story with a theme of self-acceptance and celebrating differences. These are kind of hardwired into all my books.
Yes.
Those themes. But this one has a conservation backdrop, a conservation theme as well.
Oh, it sounds amazing.
We'll have to
see if we can snaffle a copy.
I'll have to send you one.
Oh, that would be great. Well, Michelle, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on The Mavens. Where can we find you online if our listeners are interested in checking out your books?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm on Twitter at Michelle, MICHELLER, Reader, READER. I'm on Facebook, Michelle Catarusman, children's author. And I'm on Goodreads as well.
Oh, brilliant. Well, thank you once again, Michelle. I am sorry, I'm coughing and choking today. We can't wait to hear what you have in the future. And maybe you'll stop back into the Mavens after you manage to get to Borneo.
I would love to. And I'm coming back to Australia soon as well. So I would love to meet in person.
Oh, brilliant. Drop us a line. Thanks again, Thanks. Michelle.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Kate O'Donnell is a children's bookseller based in Melbourne. She divides her time between the Younger Son Bookshop in Yarraville, Victoria, where she's worked since its inception in 2007, and as a project editor at Scribble, while writing books for teenagers on the side. Kate is passionate about getting the best books into the hands of as many readers as possible. We spoke to Kate about a month ago about the changing times during COVID-19. We loved Kate's book recommendations and decided, wouldn't it be great to get her back to tell us about next month's new releases? So hi, Kate, and thanks for joining us again at Middle Grade Mavens.
Thanks, Julie. It's so nice to come back.
It's hard to believe it's been a month, really, but yeah.
I know. When I think about the fact that we've had 6 months of this year already.
But it's amazing.
Feeling pretty lucky in Australia, so.
Yeah. So I guess since we are still living through a global pandemic, I think it's important to always begin with, how are you doing?
Personally, I'm doing well.
Right.
And also in terms of the shop, we're really doing well as well. So we pivoted as requested and changed our business model to a delivery system.
Yeah.
And it's worked really, really well. We've had a lot of fun, and we've become very tired delivering. So grateful to all of our locals and not so locals who've ordered from us. And I may have said this last time, but getting to peek into the homes and lives of our customers has been really special. And so I think that we're going to be a closer community because of it. But we're really excited at the moment to have opened for click and collect. So people are coming past the shop these days and
collecting
orders.
Oh, fantastic. Well, that's kind of my second question, is how's the delivery going? But now that there's click and collect, that's even better.
Yeah, it is. It's really great. So we are still delivering to people who are isolating still in Yarraville and Seddon.
Yeah.
On our bike, which is, it's so much easier. We don't have to get the car anymore. We were doing a lot of far away deliveries.
Yeah.
So we've had to rein that in a little and open the doors every day between, I think it's 11 and 3 that we've got the doors open.
Beautiful.
Collect, which is
and great. Do you just sort of drive up? Because I know it's very hard to park near the youngest son.
At the moment, it's not. When I'm coming to work, I can park in the all-day section at the railway station and find somewhere.
No one's going to work. Yeah. Oh, that's great. So tell us about some books that have caught your eye that were released late May, because I think we caught up in early or late April even,
it might
maybe.
Be April, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've got a couple from May, but I've also got a few that are a little older. I hope that's all right.
Oh, of course. Bring on the gold.
Excellent. And also I was just thinking, recommending books when you can't see them has always been really, really strange. So all your listeners are just hearing my disembodied voice talk about books. But to be honest, we've been doing this recommending books by phone during the pandemic. And so it's not as strange.
Yeah.
But I do miss being able to show the books as I talk about them. So please just know that I'm holding them as I talk about them and turning their pages and dog-earing them.
Yes.
And I encourage you all to pick up books and do the same.
And also we put all the links in the show notes so people can see the covers as well.
Right. That's really great. Okay, so just quickly, a couple from May that we've loved in nonfiction is The Super Sporty Girls, which is a nonfiction book kind of in the vein of Rebel Girls about Australia's amazing sportswomen.
Oh, great.
Trace Bella's book Landing with Wings came out in May and is so beautiful, like River Time and Rock Hopping, absolutely beautiful. Probably don't need to mention Real Pigeons, Peck Punches came out, Andrew McDonald and Ben Wood, that's brilliant.
Yes.
Her Perilous Mansion by Sean. I'm just going to whiz through a couple and then I'm going to focus on a few.
Yep, sure.
Sean Williams' Her Perilous Mansion is really exciting, middle grade. The third book in the Narrowway trilogy, Audley Coulter and the Withering World by Rhiannon Williams, is we're so excited to have that one come in. So it's the third and final. And the sequel to A Girl Called Justice, which is called The Smuggler's Secret by Ellie Griffiths, has come in. And that's an amazing series for those readers that loved Murder Most Unladylike.
Oh, yes. Yes, we've reviewed that on the pod.
Yeah. It's we love Murder Most Unladylike, so it's really good to have something to go on with. But here are some of the ones that I've wanted to focus on a little bit more closely. So an older title, we're going back, is a picture book called Everybody Counts, A Counting Story from Zero to 7.5 Billion by Kristen Roskift, which is published by Wide-Eyed Editions. It's absolutely extraordinary. It's bright and colourful cover with lots of different faces on it, illustrated faces. And on the inside, the humans depicted are all in colour against a simple blue line illustration depicting a scene like a playground, a shopping centre, the inside of someone's home. And this is a counting book like you haven't seen before. The first page is zero and there's a simple line illustration and the text just reads no one. And then as you go on, it's kind of like a Where's Wally but with emotional intelligence. That's kind of So it's a book about connections and coincidences. I'll just read a couple of my favourites here.
Please do.
So 24 people at a flea market. One of them finds a missing teddy. One of them buys something she doesn't need. Two of them buy things to use for fancy dress costumes. And so you need to look in the illustrations and try to recognise who that person is that they're talking about. So it's perfect for recognizing expression, body language. So amazing for developing your visual literacy skills or your detective skills, whichever you'd prefer.
Beautiful.
Number 85. Oh, 85 people at the cinema. The film makes one of them see the world in a new light. Three of them think it's boring. One of them will watch the film again in 82 years. So it's the most extraordinary book for our times, I think, as we talk about community and as we come together while we're apart. And in my wobblier moments, it brings me to tears.
Yes.
But at the same time, I don't think it's just a book for navel-gazing adults, because it's fun and meaningful and both brain and heart expanding. So I highly recommend Everybody Counts.
Oh, hang on, I've lost you.
Oh, should we do that again?
Oh, no. I think it's Julie with the technology. Sorry, no, we heard all of that.
Yeah, okay.
I would like to say that I think I need to order this book yesterday for our four-year-old with autism.
Yes.
Because they don't understand the, you know, they don't get context. So yeah,
exactly. And it is tricky. It's not not as simple as some of the other books you've seen about expression and everything, but it's so beautiful. And at the end, there's questions and prompts that you can go through together. And there's also there's answers to those questions in case you haven't picked it up.
Right.
So it's amazing. There's also a new book by Heidi McKinnon called There's No Such Thing, published by Allen and Unwin. And she's the author of I Just Ate My Friend and Baz and Benz. And it's another simple, strange and very funny picture book. Bear is camping and he's hearing lots of very strange noises, but in the company of his teddy, he's able to reassure himself that it's not a monster, surely, that every scary noise and flight of his imagination is just his imagination. But, is it? And it's just such a great twist at the end, like you've come to expect from Heidi, with the really simple dark black background and very colourful characters.
She's really burst on the scene, hasn't she?
She has. And I think, all of her books are such a pleasure. I Just Ate My Friend is still one that I enjoy picking up. And when I saw it, I was in France about 18 months ago, 2 years ago, and saw it in French and in other languages. It was really exciting. Oh,
brilliant.
Glad to know she's had some success. Another book that did come out back in March, but we didn't actually get it until this past month, is an American title called Everyone's Awake by Colin Molloy and illustrated by Sean Harris, published by Chronicle Books. And Everyone's Awake is a rhyming picture book, and those are really hard. I don't know if you feel the same way as I do, but there's a lot of rhyming books out there, and the ones that are so good and stand out, I just have to buy them.
Yes, yep.
And this book, so Colin Molloy is the lead singer of the band The Decemberists and the author of middle grade series Wildwood. And he's also married to Carson Ellis, who is a beautiful illustrator of picture books and other things.
Wow.
And I also wanted just to read the first few pages of this book because I think it gives you such a sense of what it is. So Everyone's Awake. The crickets are all peeping. The moon shines on the lake. We should be soundly sleeping, but everyone's awake. Dad had done the dishes. Mum had locked the doors. I was snuggled up in bed listening for the snores of all my fellow housemates till it occurred to me that all my fellow housemates were as wakeful as could be. Grandma's at her needlework. Dad is baking bread. My brother's making laundry lists of every book he's read. Sister's flossing braces and reciting Baudelaire while she's locked inside the bathroom tying plaits into her hair. We all got tucked in early. A full tomorrow waits. But here it's almost midnight and everyone's awake. I saw this read on Instagram by Emma Straub from Books of Magic in America, and that's where we discovered it. It's so wonderful. And not only is the text like a complete romp and really evocative, but the illustrations by Sean Harris are full of extra imagination. They're really luscious. It's been illustrated in Pantone colours, so it's bright. And it does kind of have a retro feel because of those Pantones, that spot colour illustration.
Yes.
And a great feel. A bit Dr. Seuss, a bit, I don't know what. It's so wonderful. And the house this family live in, I just want to live there.
I think I'm going to have to start putting some pennies aside for my days that Kate recommends books, because we're going to go broke.
and it also made me think about rhyming. And because this is an American book, I read mum, not mom, just because that's my preference.
Yes,
But I was thinking about the way different accents make rhyme really hard when you're buying international rights and books are being published in different territories. And I was like, I like Iggy Peck. It's such a great book. That series is really fun. But the rhyme and rhythm is a little clunky in those second and third books. And I keep thinking of that moment in Sophia Valdez's Future Prez, which I do love. Like, it's a great book. But when they try to make Australians rhyme squirrel with girl.
Oh, my gosh.
Squirrel and girl. Anyway, that's just my little thoughts on my books. another recent release, No Never, by Libby Haythorne and Lisa Haythorne Jarman, and illustrated by Mel Pierce. Where this is a funny little book that kind of slipped under our radar a little bit until we had it. We've since there are no customers in the shop, we've been having a lot of read aloud story times between staff. It's such a pleasure.
Yep.
And No Never is a cautionary tale about a little girl discovers the phrase "No, never." So this is a book where your parents and carers will relate to.
I can't, we're going to have to buy all these books.
That's great to hear.
Which is great because you are our local, so.
Pretty great. Thanks, Julie. So that's the picture books that I thought we could go through. Moving on to middle grade, I've just got a couple here. Sweep by Jonathan Oxier, published by Amulet Abrams. So this is from the States as well, which is the story of a girl and her monster, and they are outcasts in their world. So they take off together to start a new life. It's a dark and twisting tale. So it's just the thing for everyone who's seeking a richly drawn world full of wonder and grit and a pinch of sooty magic. And now I know I've been reading a lot and everyone's probably bored of my voice, but when Jess, my colleague, read this book, I haven't read this one yet, but Jess loved it, and she quotes this bit every time, so I think I need to read it just to really drag you all into the story. So, if you have never climbed inside a chimney, perhaps you are wondering what it's like. Imagine holding an open book. Maybe you are holding one right now. Imagine a black tunnel exactly that size, an endless winding tunnel with no lights at the end. Imagine that the walls of the tunnel are sharp enough to cut your skin bloody. Imagine some of the walls will crush you if you touch them wrong. Imagine some of the walls are on fire. Now imagine placing a cloth over your head and take a deep breath, if you still can, and crawl inside.
Oh my gosh.
This is so beautiful, and I can't wait to read this one too. So highly recommended by Jess.
He also wrote The Midnight Gardener, I think, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. One of those books where you're like, I'll never write anything like it.
Oh, my gosh. All of these are just that. Although I did find With Everybody Counts, I found that as a writer really inspiring. I think it's a really beautiful example of how to get meaning like a single sentence. So we also have to take inspiration from these books.
Of course.
Another middle grade, which was from March as well, so I'm going back a little, is The Republic of Birds by Jessica Miller, and that's published by Text Publishing.
Yep.
Jessica's Australian. I actually think she is in Australia at the moment, though she lives.
Yes, she's stuck. She's stuck here, I think.
Yep. I wasn't going to say stuck. And The Republic of Birds is a magical story. So, well, Olga, the main character, lives in this world where magic is banned. And if you do display magical tendencies, you're whisked away to a life in Bleak Step, where by rumour and folklore it would have it that things are very grim. And the writing is really beautiful and evocative here as well, and the characters and actions perfect for the readership. So we highly recommend that.
And, of course, I was a massive fan of Elizabeth and Zenobia, Jessica's first book. So, yep.
I can't wait to read whatever she's got on the go now.
Yeah, yep.
And for YA, I got my hands. We had a bit of a fight, actually, at the younger son over this one. We received a copy of The End of the World is Greater Than Love by Davina Bell.
I've just ordered it from you.
Also published by Text Publishing. I somehow managed to wrestle it first. And my thoughts on this one are kind of still percolating because it was so wonderful, not because any other reason. And I've had to give it to Ella, who now has to pass it on to Edie and Jess and Claire once she's done.
Yep.
And The End of the World is Greater Than Love is a post-apocalyptic YA fiction that is so beautiful that I think I cried on most pages. Identical twins Summer and Winter, are living in an old church on an island, alone, separated from the rest of the world. The internet has gone. There's been a pandemic. And the girl's father, who is no longer with them, and we don't know why, he's had something to do with what's happened in the world. And so this is post-apocalyptic fiction with humour and sadness tied together. And one of my favourite things is the way that Davina's explored this existence, placing importance on the big questions of who are we, why are we here, what is our world, along with the small and more insignificant details of a teenage girl's life.
Yeah.
And this one's told in alternating parts, and summer and winter are telling the story differently. So the reader's put on edge. We don't know who to believe. We don't know what's real. And it was so absorbing, and I can't wait to read it again. So I'll be buying it this week as well.
Fantastic. Yep.
So there's my May.
I love it. On to June.
Well, I did, yeah. Davina's is actually coming out in June, but I've already read it. So.
Yep.
So in June also we've got some really exciting middle grade coming. So Eloise and the Bucket of Stars by Janine Bryan is published by Walker Books, and this is a magic realism novel that I'm really excited to read. And Zana Freyon has got The Lost Soul Atlas coming out. So her book's The Bone. This is, I think, going to be most similar to The Bone Sparrow. And this one explores homelessness, poverty and corruption.
We have it on our Mavens hit list.
Oh, it's great.
It's coming our way. So, yep.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, she breaks my heart, Zana, so I'm really excited to read it. And then moving forward a little bit more into July, so I always look forward to the Ampersand Prize winning books.
Yes.
Hardy Grant Egmont. And so we've got Stars Like Us by Frances Chapman coming out in July. And this is a music book, which is personally, I'm so excited. So I love to hear about characters in bands and who create music.
Beautiful.
And there's a book coming out called The Snowman's Wish by Sophie Masson and illustrated by Ronak Taher by Dirt Lane Press. And anyone who isn't familiar with Dirt Lane Press, I think would be great to go and check them out. So their publishing is very interesting and very different, unlike a lot of the mainstream publishing. Offering something that I think you're not going to get anywhere else. They do folk tales. It's got a very European, I don't want to say old-fashioned, because it's very much, all their books are very much modern stories, but the way that they're told and their sort of aesthetic has this really immersive European feel.
Yep.
And I also just wanted to point out the Love Oz YA website, because that's an amazing place to go for all the Australian YA releases each month. Yes. And they could do a better job of highlighting all those titles than I could right now. But on my TBR for June, I've got Please Don't Hug Me by Kay Kerr and Anna Whatley's book as well.
Yes, yep. Peter Lies Rating Normal, I think it's called, that's isn't it? Right. Yep.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, I think you're once again a high achiever, Kate O'Donnell, with the most incredible book recommendations. Is that all, or did I interrupt?
No, that's everything. I think that's I'm exhausted, and I'm just finding I'm not getting enough time to read at the moment. So there's all these books, like the pile on the beside of my bed is going to kill me.
Yes,
when it topples one night, but yeah. That's okay.
We have a similar pile.
I bet.
So what a delight to have you back, Kate. Where can we find The Younger Son online if our listeners are keen to order?
So you can find our online shop at sunbookshop.com. And if you are looking for recommendations, please go no further than our Instagram, which is The Younger Son, S-U-N for the sun. and we're there. We can give you recommendations by email, by DM, or you can call us at the shop. If you look up the website, we now have a direct phone line to The Younger Son. So you can
Brilliant. Get right
here.
Well, that might be a bit dangerous. I might just give you a call every now and then.
Please do. And you can text us. We've been texting
with
some of our customers.
Fantastic. Oh, well, thank you again, Kate, and we can't wait to have you back. So, yeah, stay tuned, listeners.
Thanks for having me.
We hope you are enjoying our show. Next up, Pamela reviews When Rain Turns to Snow by Jane Godwin, and Julie reviews The Secret Library of Hummingbird House by Julianne Negri. If you'd like to know more about the Mavens, log on to middlegradepodcast.com, or to find Julie online, drop by julieannegrassobooks.com. And to find Pamela, stop by www.ueckerman.net.